Welcome to Worlds Apart. If the American approach to the world could be reduced to one bumper sticker, it well could be this: perception is reality. Coined in the early 1990s by the prominent Republican strategist Lee Atwater, it made ample use of falsehoods and dirty tricks, but nonetheless proved very effective in securing the presidential victories of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. 40 years on, how big is the gap between American perception and global reality? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Lu Xin, an anchor with China's state-run CGTN channel. Xin, it's great pleasure for me to talk to you. I'm such a big fan of your work. Thank you very much for making the time for me.
Thank you for the invitation. Yes, I come from CGTN. We call ourselves the International Television of China.
Now, I mentioned you're working for a state-run channel without any judgment. I myself work for a state-funded channel and in fact see a great value in a national effort to try to shape the global story. But I noticed that when you talk to some of our Western colleagues, they're always a bit skeptical, if not condescending, of your affiliation. It's as if your affiliation somehow influences the quality of your work. Do you have anything to say on that?
The reason why I have to correct people almost all the time, including my colleagues from RT, for instance, is because I believe this is part of the efforts to use perception to shape people's understanding of the world. Because in a Western context, the word state is almost has a very negative connotation to it. It's opposed to the people. It represents power that is not necessarily representing the overall interest of the people. It is kind of viewed as the opposite side. Whereas in the Eastern context, for instance, it is very different. And so I don't want to be given that label before I open my mouth, which is the case every time. And I don't know about your case on Twitter, for instance. We are given the label state affiliated media, which immediately gives people the impression that we are not so credible. What we say is propaganda, so be very, very careful. Whereas those people who work for money, you know, they're not given the tag corporate media, for instance. If you look at state-run media, we have many state-run media, by the way, all over the world.
You mentioned this distinction between perception and reality, and you heard my introduction. This mantra is, I think, very central to how Western media operate. And since you cater to an international audience, I'm sure you encounter the effects of it in your work, but do you subscribe to it? Do you believe that perception trumps reality rather than the other way around?
I think perception is unfortunately a way how human beings see the world, whether we like it or not. And that is used sometimes for a good cause, sometimes for a bad cause. It can be weaponized. Everything we are doing in journalism is about perception, because you are hearing me talking about China or about myself, and it is your perception that will make up your mind what you see, what you get, or what you the kind of image you conjure in your brain. So perception is absolutely critical. But how do we make sure that we don't manipulate perception so that people have the wrong or a very an impression of reality that is very much twisted or very distant from reality? I think that is the challenge, because nobody is able to give reality 100% as it is. But how close are you able to give it, and how truthful, how genuinely professionally you're trying to do a job? I think that is the biggest challenge, really.
Now, I mentioned Lee Atwater in my introduction, the U.S. Republican strategist, who, in my view, influenced the American political and media communications for decades to come. And he also played on these very emotional badge issues and all sorts of unscrupulous means. He truly believed, he was very open about it, that any means justify the goal. And it also needs to be added that he died very young of a brain tumor. I wonder if you think that this approach of trying to manipulate the perception so that you have the reality that you like, if it's actually durable, doesn't it tend to sort of choke up on its own contents or over a pretty short period of time?
Misperception is very easy to make if you're very good at it. For instance, if you work in the media and you know how to do it, you can do a very good job at manipulating public opinion. You can paint white as black. You can, you know, totally twist reality. And sometimes not even by lying, sometimes just by picking what you want to pick or putting things in a certain order or putting human emotions into one side of the story while not giving irrational analysis of the whole picture. And that's what we're living in on a daily basis, not just what we see in our hands on TV, in our phones, but also how what we produce constantly as journalists, as TV presenters. So it is, I have to say, it is part of human nature that we're prone to be manipulated. It is also the beauty of human life, that we are emotional animals. The challenge is whether we're able to cultivate our literacy, our ability to distinguish what is misinformation, what is what's perception, what's reality, and how we can arm ourselves with the ability to say, okay, this is perceived in this way, but what is the reality? That we are in a constant pursuit of truth as close as possible.
You know, as I was preparing for this conversation, I came across your interview with ABC. I think it was filmed last year, where the journalist, the Australian journalist, tried to grill you on the state of media freedoms in China and how supposedly constricted it is in comparison to the West. And fast forward 1 year, and I'm sitting here in Moscow with my channel being taken off the air, off social media for explicitly political reasons. And to me, it's not even ironic. I think there's something very totalitarian in that. And that's why I wanted to try to turn the tables here and ask you about the state of media freedoms in the West as you see it.
I think at this moment, we see extremely clear what they mean by freedom of press, right? When freedom of press is in other countries, they're defending it. They are even paying money. The latest U.S. Competes Act allocates actually $500 million to, foster so-called independent media in China, basically to malign China. But when it comes to freedom of press in their own countries, I'm not sure whether they're really leading by example, despite their claims. As you said, RT is taken off air, which is out of the reach by the regulators. I understand it is not done through due process. There are all kinds of bottom lines that have been just totally ripped apart because I guess it's a war on the West that Russia is waging. And for them, it's just totally not possible. And everything Russian seemed to have become a target. So where's the freedom of expression there? So I think it is laid bare in front of the rest of the world what they really mean by freedom of expression, how unified their standard really is. But you know the problem, they are always right. When it comes, you know, they can never be wrong so long as they are on the right side of history. If they have Western liberal style democracy, you know, it seems like they can justify everything they do, even if they're wrong. They do it and they still say they're right. And that is that kind of exceptionalism, that kind of double standard, I think, is really a huge problem.
But Shin, is that really exceptionalism or is it supremacy? I mean, I don't know how you approach it, but I think you're one of the most eloquent English-speaking anchors. I'm not trying to be sycophantic here, but you have very good command of the language. You use it not only to read off news, read news off AutoCue, but also in live debate and analysis. And that's a huge effort. I mean, as somebody who also speaks English as a non-native language, I understand how much work goes into that. And yet, in interview after interview, I can see you not being discounted, but sort of kept as somewhat not on par with all the people who speak English fluently just by the nature of being born in that country. I mean, do you think our colleagues, our Western colleagues, understand how much human effort goes into what we do? Not just state funds, but basic human effort into even being able to deliver what we are trying to deliver in that language and also within the framework of the world, because you are not only learning the language, you are also learning the culture, the worldview, etc.
I think one idiom would be good here. It's their house, so we have to follow their rules. And if you want to speak to an international audience, which is, you know, prevalent in English, which is English speaking primarily, you have to learn their language, you have to learn their culture. And I was an English language major when I was in university, that was in last century. And I've been using English for all these years. I've had so much discussion. Sometimes in my spare time, I talk to myself, I ask myself questions. There's so much thinking that's going on, so much discussion, so much reading. Why? Not because I like it or I'm mad or something, because these are the questions that we want to answer. How can we talk to people in other parts of the world who don't speak Chinese? I have to reach out to them, and I cannot wait for everybody to be able to speak Chinese, because then we will never understand each other. So I want to reach out, I want to go over, but it's very, very difficult. 25 years I've been working in this profession. I love it. I'm enjoying it, and I'm ever more energized and empowered, but it's not been an easy path. That's why I'm angry. I'm angry when people say, oh, you come from the state media, you're doing propaganda. I say, excuse me, there are thousands of people, more than thousands of, tens of thousands of people who are working extremely hard to bring information from one language, from our native language, which is Chinese, to you. And you say in one word, propaganda, you discredit everything. That's why I'm extremely angry. Don't mess with me. That's what I say, because I won't take it.
I remember that back in 2019, you had a bit of an argument with the Fox News host. You described her as being all emotion and little substance. And I think that was a frankly fair criticism. But I want to ask you, why do you think emotionality rather than critical thinking has become such a dominant feature of Western broadcasting? Because arguably it's easy for them to not only talk but think in English, but for some reason there's a very, very determined push and pull towards emotionality.
First, I have to say, with all due respect to Trish Regan, my counterpart in that debate, when I wrote that opinion piece, which triggered the debate, I didn't mean to say that she was all emotions and no substance. But you see, that's the problem, because I was thinking in Chinese and I wrote the piece. I was actually saying her research was not well done, but I really didn't accuse her of being, you know, all emotions and no brains. But I guess that, you know, that made her feel offended. And
but
she
it's not about her, her personality or even her style. My question is more about the general approach to work.
When talking about emotionality, we mentioned it just now. I say we are all emotional animals. That's why life is so beautiful. That's why life is so easily manipulated. That's why we're so credulous as well. That's why we as journalists who are people who can shape people's minds have such a huge responsibility that we do not use emotion in an excessive, in a manipulative way. Sometimes there are true emotions which have to come out, and it can be extremely powerful. I'm not shunning away from emotion, but when you are making emotion to push your political agenda, I think that is a very dangerous thing. So both as a reader, both as a consumer of information and as a producer of information, I'm extremely aware when it comes to emotion. I'd rather keep my tears in my eyes when I see something, because I don't want myself to be manipulated by my emotions. And according to Western philosophy, actually, what is freedom? Freedom is when you are able to restrain your animal instinct and make the right choices despite your emotions. That is when you achieve true freedom. And I want to have that kind of freedom. And I want to give my audience the choice to have that freedom as well.
Shin, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Але ми тут знаходимося для того, щоб від імені американського народу висловити вам підтримку.
Free world is with you. America is with you. I am with you.
Але вони зрозуміли. Горонаті!
Завтра підемо разом вперед. Якщо куля в лоб, то куля в лоб.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with CGTN anchor Lu Xin. Xin, I wanted to ask you about the coverage of Russian military action in Ukraine from the Chinese perspective. But before we go there, this is not the first conflict in which Russia and the West find themselves on the opposite sides. We've been there in Libya, in Syria, on many other issues. And I wonder, how is it perceived from so far away in the East? Do you see that as struggles within Europe, as struggles within the West, or do you see Russia as a separate entity, neither with the West nor with the East, or perhaps both here and there?
I think it's really a very good question, because Russia straddles Europe and Asia. Part of you is the West, part of you is in the East. So Russia is really in a very unique situation. And I think that kind of explains the kind of complex situation you are in vis-a-vis the West or vis-a-vis Europe. Sometimes I make mistakes. I say, look, I told my German interviewer, for instance, I said, look, Russia is not going away. Russia is right at Europe. But after I say that, I said, Russia is also part of Europe. So this relationship, love and hate, if you like it, between Russia and Europe will very much determine how you get along with each other. But at the end of the day, you are not drifting away from each other. Russia will always be there geographically. Europe will always be there geographically. You have to find a way to coexist. And people are feeling the pains when you are not able to do that.
We often hear from Western commentators that in its final analysis, China would always put material or even monetary considerations first above everything else. And I think that's one of the reasons why many Western analysts were surprised by Chinese reaction to Russia's actions. It wasn't pro-Russian by any means. It wasn't also pro-Western. It was firm, but also very much aware of the context. And I wonder if you personally have noticed any change in Beijing's position, in how Beijing presents itself on the international stage during this crisis, or perhaps even before that?
I wouldn't say I perceived a change in position, because China, I actually wrote an opinion piece on this since the start of the war, and I wanted to look at China's traditional foreign policy and to find out if there is any legacy that has been inherited. And I think it is very clear. Look, China has the five principles of peaceful coexistence, for instance, non-interference in each other's internal affairs, respect of sovereignty and territorial integrity, mutual respect, mutual benefit, and peaceful coexistence. Peaceful coexistence basically is what Russia and Europe wants from each other. And I think in that regard, Chinese position has always been persistent, has always been the same.
Do you think China has become perhaps a little bit more forthcoming in stating its position, a little bit more blunt, if I may say so? Because it's
I haven't noticed the change. Let me repeat that. I haven't noticed the change. Just recently, the Chinese State Council and Foreign Minister said China wants peace in Ukraine. And I think from the very beginning, that message is very clear. So I haven't noticed a considerable shift, because China is also a friendly country with Ukraine, also friendly in terms with the West, also wants to be in good terms with the United States. And of course, Russia is also extremely important for China. We have a very strong relationship back to back. So this peace, And of course, war is no good for anybody. So peace is the message, has always been the message. I think this is consistent.
I also want to highlight for our audience how China reacted to the UN draft resolution on Russia's actions. And the Chinese side specifically pointed out that the draft doesn't take into full consideration the history and complexity of the current crisis. This obfuscation of the context that the Chinese side clearly points to, is that a matter of ignorance on the part of the West, or do you think it's a deliberate tactic?
Well, I think nothing comes out of the blue. There is, when there is a result, there is always a cause. And I interviewed ordinary Chinese people on the street. They're well aware of the history, you know, the five rounds of NATO expansion, for instance, towards Russia, the very complex relationship between the people of Ukraine and the people of Russia, and what has happened in eastern Ukraine since 2014. So there's not a clear cut right or wrong, or who did, who started the first shot, or, you know, so to try to do that would be, or try to make things look like that would be counterproductive, because if you have a military conflict, the most important thing is to find ways to stop it as soon as possible. So anything that is considered not conducive to finding a peaceful and quick solution to the conflict is considered not in the interest of China. And China believes, I understand China believes that is not in the interest of world peace either. So that's why China abstain. And that position is actually shared. And I think this piece of information is not understood widely by people in the West adequately, that position is actually shared by the great majority of countries in the world. You have 141 countries voting in favor of that resolution, of the UN General Assembly resolution, but you have 35 countries abstaining and five countries, including Russia, voting against. If you take out the population of Russia, the population of those who are against the resolution actually are the majority of people in the world. So I think that says a lot. And the West didn't get the word they wanted. They didn't get people to agree to condemn Russia on
resolution. Let me ask you about that specifically, because I found this fascinating. You know, you're saying that the West didn't get the words that it wanted, because in your analysis of that resolution, you make a clear distinction between the word condemned, which the American media put in the headlines, and the word deplore, which was actually featured in the text of the resolution. And you say that the choice of words was critical there for, you know, for the ultimate count. I mean, if the choice of words would have been different, the count would also have been different. How come a Chinese journalist like yourself is more attentive, more sensitive to the variations of meaning in English than our native speaking colleagues? Isn't that ironic?
I don't know. I ask that questions too sometimes. That's why sometimes I cannot tell whether it was an honest mistake or disinformation. Now, that's the distinction between misinformation and disinformation. I think as native speakers, they must know the difference between contamination and deplore. By the way, it's to deplore in the strongest terms. So there's a slight difference there. But still, to deplore and to condemn are different words. To condemn is much stronger, and it has a moral aspect to it, right? You condemn something that is almost considered evil. So the one US mainstream media television actually said the UN passes a resolution to condemn Russia. And if you look at the original text, it doesn't actually say, it condemns the announcement of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, but it doesn't condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine per se. It deplores in the strongest terms. So these are the details that often gets lost. And that's why sometimes it is very difficult, it's very easy for disinformation or misinformation to travel because people are lazy. How many of our viewers will go to the original source to look through all of the piles of documents that's hidden somewhere and to go through the legal language? Some of it is really not very human friendly, and to find the differences between condemn and deplore. They would just say, oh, this well-regarded television says so, so it must be the case. And my question, my job is to ask exactly what happened and why it happened. Is it an honest mistake or was it something more than that? Sometimes I can't tell. I hope it's not disinformation. I hope it's just an honest mistake.
I want to ask you something about which you just mentioned, that the international audiences, our viewers, can sometimes be, well, I don't want to call them lazy, but I think people have been indulged in infotainment for way too long and their attention spans are rather short. They not always want to get into the sort of depth of the issues. How do you personally decide how nerdy you can afford to be with your analysis without alienating your audiences? I'm sorry for asking this, but this is also a very pressing issue for me as well, because I like thinking and analyzing, but I understand that some people don't take it easily.
Yeah. No, you know, I am the kind of person that doesn't take no as an answer. And I just bought a model of a human brain from Taobao, the Chinese shopping platform. I say, I'm going to put that model of a human brain. It's half out of a box. I want to put it on the table of all my colleagues and make them think out of the box all the time, because that's what we have to do. How we do our job in an entertaining, easy to follow way that's still extremely professional, and that is honest and fair and easy to follow. When I write my script, I sometimes joke about it. I say, look, my audience, let's imagine they have primary school literacy level. Let's not use huge words, because they're going to scratch their heads. And then if they scratch once, twice, they're going to say, okay, she looks nice, but I'm going to switch channels. I don't want that to happen. So I try to make it interesting, and I try to illustrate what I say, because the human brain works in a way that when they see something, they tend to believe it. That's why more and more, if you go on social media, for instance, you see messages being put into graphics instead of mere language typed words, because that is more effective when you want to send certain messages. Mm-hmm. And I noticed the US State Department is doing more and more of that. I notice more and more social influencers trying to do that. Sometimes I do that, but I try not to do, because when you have to do that, I'm like, beware. They want to say something that is very, 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 they want you to see. But it's a fascinating thing, but I think there is a way to do it without going low, without sacrificing the quality of the discussion, and still bringing out the best discussion you can have and still make it fun. That's my aim.
Well, Shin, if my opinion counts for anything, you do it brilliantly. Thank you very much for this opportunity to engage with you. It's been a great pleasure for me.
Thank you so much, Oksana, for the invitation, and the best luck for your job. Keep it up.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.